We're going to continue tonight with question 138 in the larger and question 71 in the shorter catechism. Having discussed the theory when we talked about what the seventh commandment is, the next two questions are really going to cover what it requires on the one hand, which is what we want to talk about this evening, and what it forbids. If we look at the shorter catechism, what is required in the seventh commandment? The seventh commandment requireth the preservation of our own and our neighbor's chastity in heart, speech, and behavior. We see the general requirement, the general thrust of this command is, in fact, chastity in all that we think, all that we say, and all that we do. The larger catechism, as we will see, has special rules, additional observations, things that have been added for clarification and to make it more pointed, to help give us some direction. Question 138, what are the duties required in the seventh commandment? The duties required in the seventh commandment are chastity in body, mind, affections, words, and behavior, and the preservation of it in ourselves and others. Watchfulness over the eyes and all the senses, temperance, keeping of chaste company, modesty in apparel, marriage by those that have not the gift of continency, conjugal love and cohabitation, diligent labor in our callings, shunning all occasions of uncleanness and resisting temptations thereunto. We're going to talk about these things from the positive point of view this week. Next week, Lord willing, we'll talk about them from the other perspective as negatives. But first of all, we need to understand that, like all of the commands, this command not only forbids, but requires. There are, in fact, duties which are implied in this command, and those duties require our active participation. It's not simply enough that we yield passive obedience. The commands all require that we are engaged and that we yield an active obedience. And so, with regard to this commandment, there are a number of things that the larger catechism sets out in particular that instruct us that we might do positively or even preemptively so that we do not run afoul of breaking this commandment. It's very easy to fall into sin with regard to all of the commandments, but this one in particular is one of those commands that I think not only in this age, but in all ages, men have been reasonably prone to break. The first question we want to discuss then is, this seventh commandment requires duties with respect to what? The larger catechism expands upon this idea of chastity that is talked about in the shorter catechism. But we know the seventh commandment has to do with chastity or purity. It has to do with endeavoring to keep a measure of honesty in our society. So this command speaks to a series of duties respecting this chastity as pertains, first of all, we're told, to the body, for which one procures sanctification with respect to God and honesty with respect to man. Look at 1 Thessalonians 4:4.
1 Thessalonians 4, verse 4. That every one of you should know how to possess his vessel in sanctification and honor.
Positively, and we could look at that passage, but I don't want to this week because we're going to talk about it in fuller context next time. But in the middle of the negatives, Paul says to the Thessalonians, the seventh commandment requires positively this possession of your body in purity, in chastity. That is, you have to possess your body with a level of honesty that comports with that society in which you find yourself. Nobody is living unto themselves. Every man has a mutual responsibility to every other man. And that responsibility grows as those relations grow. So the more close and intimate the relations, the more necessary this kind of civil honesty is required. It requires men to possess their bodies in chastity with particular reference to the service of God. We can see this if we look at 1 Samuel 21, verse 5.
1 Samuel 21, verse 5. And David answered the priest and said unto him, of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in a manner common, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel.
Why is it throughout the Old Testament there is this concern that those who are waiting on the things of the altar have, in fact, maintained this kind of chastity or honesty in their, particularly in the most intimate society? There is a relationship between this command and the second commandment. There is, in fact, an analogousness that we'll talk about next time between bodily chastity and spiritual chastity. And so in the Old Testament, this is particularly borne out, but this idea is not confined to the Old Testament. This is one of these ceremonial observances that actually teaches us a lesson, a spiritual lesson. And this lesson has ramifications that affect everything that you are going to do. If you're not honest in those affairs of your life that are most intimate and touch you, you're not going to be honest in any relation with respect to the church or with respect to God. So there is, in fact, a training of yourself in honesty in this matter. Purity, honesty, chastity, these are all related concepts, and they're all, in fact, tied together, which is why Paul talks about possessing your vessel in honor and sanctification. Right. Possessing the body in honor entails then purging of all that offends in order to seek the glory of God. Look at 2 Timothy 2:21.
2 Timothy 2, verse 21. If any man therefore purge himself from these, he shall be a vessel unto honor, sanctified and meet for the master's use and prepared unto every good work.
When we consider what Paul says about the body being the temple of God, there is, in fact, implied in that this kind of intimacy. that there is a necessity of honesty in your body in order for there to be communion with God. And that we're going to see and we will talk about with respect to some of the particulars that the divines lay out both this week and next week. But this possessing of the body in honor requires not simply shunning, but the fact that we are born in sin, the fact that we have indwelling sin, requires that there be an active purging on our part. Our affections are, in fact, disordered by reason of sin. We have native depravity, indwelling corruption. There has to be a mortification of sin. There has to be a putting to death of the deeds of the flesh. It isn't going to happen passively. You need to take an active role in doing that. We're going to talk about how in a few minutes. Some of the rules and some of the directions that they give are very good and sound guidance in this matter. Right, the second duty respecting chastity pertains to the mind, which needs to dispose itself toward God in all chaste thoughts. Look at
Job 31:1. I made a covenant with mine eyes, why then should I think upon a maid?
Job, and we'll come back to the idea of making a covenant in a moment, but his concern in this is that he not think in a direction that's going to potentially draw him into sin. Again, this would be unnecessary, this warning, this endeavor, if man were not in a fallen condition. But we need to take an active role in suppressing, in taking command, really, of our thought life. And Job is concerned, we see, to do that. The failure to do this, Job acknowledges, in fact, as a cause of divine displeasure. Look at Job 31:9.
Job 31:9. If mine heart have been deceived by a woman, or if I have laid wait at my neighbor's door,
Job says, if my heart have been deceived by a woman. Why is it he's concerned not to think upon a maid? Because the moment you begin to go down that road and lose control of your thought life, you begin to live in a world of lies. One of the most common things you will hear from people who are involved in adultery and fornication is their minds, when they start to tell you what they're thinking, are full of lies. They believe that there's going to be a different outcome, that somehow everything will be made right in the end. And they construct elaborate fantasies, and they continue to act along that. Rational people need irrational fantasies to continue in that kind of sin. Job recognizes that connection. And the quickest way to turn yourself into a liar is, in fact, to violate this command, because you are deceived and deceiving. The third thing, the command speaks to duties respecting chastity with regard to the affections. The affections are that whereby our desires are set upon the things of God or the things of the world, the flesh, and the devil. Look at 1 Corinthians 7:34.
1 Corinthians 7:34. There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she that is married careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband.
The fact is that our affections are going to be drawn along We're either going to gain control of them and maintain a proper orientation of them, or they're going to be drawn along in this breach of commandment. If you maintain a control over your affections, you're going to be much less likely to run afoul of this commandment. This commandment is one of those commands that in the breaking of it, it thrives on people who have absolutely no control over their passions. It works on people who are in moments of passion. It relies on that. The elevation of a disposition, the entertaining of a series of affections, and the settling of your mind on something other than the glory of God. Well, John tells us when that's happening, it's the world, the flesh, and the devil. The command also speaks to the duties respecting chastity. In the fourth place, the chastity of words, whereby we express the hidden work of grace in the heart. Look at Colossians 4:6.
Colossians 4:6. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man.
Paul talks about your speech, the words that you use. Solomon tells us, by words a gracious man seeks to open the door of salvation to those who are his hearers. Look at Proverbs 15:4.
Proverbs 15:4. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness therein is a breach in the spirit.
Wholesome words are a tree of life. We need to guard our words because our words are in fact an act of our soul going forth. And we're probing. We're prodding. We're reaching out to other people. People do judge you by the words you use. Whether they realize they're doing it or not, they judge you by the words you use. And they can tell whether or not you're educated, how well educated you are. They can tell something about your class. Whether you're upper class, middle class, lower class. There are all kinds of things that they can tell about you. With regard to your words in respect to this command, they can also tell whether or not you are someone whose mind and affections are chaste or not. If your mind and affections are not chaste, it's going to come out. It's going to come out in the things that you find humorous. It's going to come out in the topics of conversation towards which you continually drift. And it continues to erode your sensibilities. We'll come back to that. But it's important that you understand this. Wise words are vehicles of grace to others. Again, look at Ecclesiastes 10:12.
Ecclesiastes 10:12. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself.
The lips of a fool swallow up himself. Wise words are gracious words. They're vehicles of grace. They're conveying grace. That is, they're seeking to reclaim other people. The Bible, when it speaks about certain things, uses an inherent modesty. There's a modesty in the language of the Bible. When it talks about bathroom functions, it refers to covering the knees, or covering the feet, excuse me, covering the feet. When it talks about conjugal relations in marriage, It simply says things like Adam knew his wife. It's not explicit when it comes to things which require a certain amount of modesty. And that's what the divines are talking about here. Learning to speak about certain things with modesty. Our duty is not to uncover nakedness in the public square in any respect. It's unchaste. It's impure. And it introduces into society a level of dishonesty and tempts people. We're going to come back to how this affects others in a moment, but it does tempt people and draws people along. Beside the fact that, again, you are eroding your own conscience. You're hardening yourself. Right, the fifth thing that is talked about here is the duty respecting chastity as pertaining to the behavior, which, when it is chaste, makes for one of the most effective arguments for the power of true religion. Look at 1 Peter 3, verse 2.
1 Peter 3, verse 2. While they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear.
Peter says that it's easier for a believing woman to have a positive effect on an unbelieving husband simply by her chaste carriage, her chaste conversation, her behavior. You don't have to spend all of your time preaching to people if you would spend a good deal of your time controlling yourself. You are setting an example for good or for ill, and that example will, in fact, affect everyone around you, for good or for ill. And we have to understand that the consequences of breaking any of God's commands are eternal. They have the potential, you know, the least breach of any command has the potential of carrying you to hell forever if it's not repented of. If it's not, in fact, covered by Christ's shed blood, and there's atonement made. But every sin carries with it, in fact, the entire eternity of hell with it. And Peter says, on the other hand, that chaste behavior is quite possibly one of the most effective means of bringing about a change in the opinion of another person with respect to true religion. And even though this is a light of nature issue, and pagans to a certain extent expect a certain amount of honesty in their personal relations, they're not very circumspect, particularly in our day, with respect to this. This is a very different thing. They don't understand that. They don't understand how anyone could control their passions, let alone why anyone should control their passions. But our behavior ought to exhibit that kind of modesty, which is in fact becoming our place and station in life. Look at 1 Samuel 18:1.
1 Samuel 18, verse 1. And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul.
What is it that evoked that very deep love that Jonathan had for David? Jonathan beheld David's response when he was in a situation that was provocative. He beheld David's chaste response. David held himself in check. He responded in such a way that it immediately drew Jonathan in to a very intimate soul connection, that kind of camaraderie that you have with best friends. That's the kind of camaraderie that is talked about here. They would have done anything for each other. They would have stopped whatever they were doing to help each other. But what is it that set all of that in motion? It was, we're told, Jonathan beheld David in this one moment when David could have responded in a very impassioned way, but he controlled it. And that evokes from Jonathan this very deep love and respect. And that's why chaste behavior in general, whether people will acknowledge it or not, it's challenging them in the very core of their being. It's forcing them to confront things about themselves that are very uncomfortable. You know, pagans may react in a particular way, but in the end, most of them are going to begrudgingly, at the very least, respect you. They may not like it, it may make them feel very uncomfortable, but there's going to be a begrudging respect that comes from that, because they don't understand it. And yet they know that, in some respect, that kind of chastity that's being talked about is a chastity that surmounts their own ability. Because wicked men just simply don't have the ability to control their passions at any point to this kind of degree. It's very difficult for them to do it. You know, they have to engage in all kinds of bizarre acts of asceticism and weird acts of self-mutilation and self-torture to achieve that kind of balance in their lives. But Christianity, the power of Christianity, the living power of the Spirit of God and God's people should in fact exert this kind of influence over you in your behavior. And certainly this commandment is demanding that you don't simply sit back and hope that this is the outcome, but that you take an active role in seeing that you are behaving in this way. You're never going to behave in this way, though, unless you learn to take control of your affections, take control of your thought life, take control of your body, and are circumspect and control what you're saying. Behavior is just the carriage for all of that together and all of the nuances of that. That leads then to the second question, and this is where we're going to talk about a lot of the details that are set forth. What should be our study in the pressing of these duties? Well, we're told that the end of these duties is seeking of the preservation of chastity, both in ourselves and in others. Look at 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2, verse 35, and verse 36.
1 Corinthians 7, nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. 35 and 36, and this I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, and that you may attend upon the Lord without distraction. But if any man think that he behaveth himself uncomely toward his virgin, if she pass the flower of her age and need so require, let him do what he will. He sinneth not, let her marry.
This command, the duty, the active pursuit of obeying this command, means we have to seek the very course of action that is going to make everyone, not just ourselves, but everyone else, more likely rather than less likely to keep this command. In a world filled with all kinds of uncleanness, in a world where lust knows no bounds. We have to exhibit even more restraint. We're required to demonstrate what will appear to the rest of the world to be an almost inhuman power of self-control, or superhuman power of self-control. There are a number of things that we are, in fact, then able to do and should do, practical things. The Scripture gives us a number of things that we can do. The Catechism here gives us a pretty good list, I think, of things that we can actively pursue. And in so doing, put ourselves in a position to remain on the correct side of this commandment. Right, the first thing that is suggested is this: we must do nothing that may ensnare ourselves or others. Look at Habakkuk 2:15.
Habakkuk 2, verse 15. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness.
The fact is that there are a number of things that go on in society where we wittingly or unwittingly, knowingly or unknowingly, are contributing not only to the degradation of ourselves, but to the degradation of everyone around us. We're going to return to what is talked about in Habakkuk, but the fact is that there are things that we do habitually that we just simply don't think of. And yet these kinds of things are doors that open and expose people unnecessarily to various temptations, particularly temptations to breach of this commandment. Right. We need to remember whoever lays a snare is a partner for the sin that comes by it, which is evident in the case of Judah and his daughter-in-law. Look at Genesis 38, 14 to 16.
Genesis 38, verses 14 through 16. And she put her widow's garments off from her, and covered her with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given unto him to wife. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be an harlot, because she had covered her face. And he turned unto her by the way, and said, Go to, I pray thee, let me come in unto thee. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, What wilt thou give me, that thou mayest come in unto me?
There are a number of things that lead up to this. Judah should have been more active, probably, in making sure that Tamar was married off. But she's not without guilt here. She actually attires herself like a harlot and sits in wait, knowing that he'll be by. On his part, he seems to be whore hunting. He's ready to take her up on the offer. There is an exchange. These are not two people who are trying to keep each other honest. These are not two people who are trying to avoid falling into sin. These are two people who are out, particularly in Tamar's case, where she shouldn't have been. She's put herself in a position, put herself in a place where harlots were known to resort. And the outcome is that we have an incestuous union. There's a gross violation of not only the explicit command of God, but the very precepts of nature, what Paul will describe in his epistle to the Corinthians as the kind of sin that even the Gentiles abhor. And this among one of the great princes of the tribes of Israel. Their partners. They've all had a hand in this. They all share guilt in this. We see this as well in Bathsheba's washing of herself in a place where she might be seen of others, because this is what became the occasion of the sin which followed. Look at 2 Samuel 11:2.
2 Samuel 11, verse 2. And it came to pass in the eventide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon.
You know, I've heard women say, that's not my fault if people are looking. It is your fault. You have a responsibility not only to yourself but to others. It is your fault. You should be concerned about this. Obviously, Bathsheba's not too concerned about who sees or what they see. That's not to say that David is without fault. We're going to return to this in a little bit. The fact is that these are the kinds of things people do, and they're not without fault in the doing of them. You dress like a harlot and hang out where harlots hang out. You do something provocative in a public place. That's sending signals. That's laying the groundwork for the sin that will follow. It's not to say that the men are without fault here. You know, we're going to return to that. There are things that they should have been doing too. And their failures in this also are contributory. And particularly in Judah's case, he seems to be a little bit eager. But the second thing is that we're to see that we do everything we can to preserve the chastity of others by not exposing them to temptations against which they may not stand. So it's not only a matter of the things that we do where we're trying to ensnare, but even exposing them to temptations. Look at 1 Corinthians 7:5.
1 Corinthians 7, verse 5. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency.
When married couples are apart for undue periods of time, it presents temptations. It's not to say that there's an ensnaring. It's just to say that there is, in fact, exposing another person to an unnecessary temptation. When we do anything that opens the way for someone else to be tempted, we may not be ensnaring them. That is, we may not be laying a trap. We may not be doing something which is going to draw them into the sin, enticing them into it. But by our simple neglect, by our simple omission, we may in fact be moving them in this direction where they're going to be exposed to a temptation that is going to be more than they can handle. Right. There are many who might have been kept from sins of uncleanness had the door been kept shut by another. Look at Amos 3:5.
Amos 3, verse 5. Can a bird fall in a snare upon the earth where no gin is set for him? Shall one take up a snare from the earth and have nothing taken at all?
If there's not a trap set, if there's no snare, of course no one's going to fall. The fact is, again, we're fallen creatures. Our passions are disordered. When we add anything to this, even by way of omission, what we're doing is we're pouring gasoline on what is already, for most people, a raging fire. Right, that brings us then to the third question. And that is, what special instructions are necessary to keep this command? There are some things that may have already come to mind as we've gone over some of these things generally. The Catechism gives us now a series of special instructions. The first is, it's very needful that a watchfulness be set over the eyes. And that is because they are the first to bring sin into the world. Look at Genesis 3:6.
Genesis 3:6. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat.
What is it that led Eve into the sin? She looked on the tree. It was very pleasant. And her desire was kindled. The very sin that brought in the fall of man began with a glance. Began with a lack of control over a glance. There was an inordinate passion that was aroused in that look. The disorder of her soul began before she took the fruit and ate it. That's the reason that Job made a covenant to be careful with his glances. So look at Job 31:1 again.
Job 31:1. Made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I think upon
it? Yeah, he made a covenant with his eyes, we're told. How's he going to control his thoughts? Well, Job is very clear. He sees the eyes as being the windows to his soul and the disordering of his entire personality. He's going to make a covenant with his eyes. He doesn't want to fall into these kinds of glances, these kind of flattering looks that people give one another with their eyes. That kind of eye contact that people make when they're looking to break this commandment. It was undoubtedly by the eye gate that David was first enticed, even by a curious or careless glance. Again, look at 2 Samuel 11:2.
And it came to pass in an evening tide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon.
What is it that David does? When he saw this, he doesn't immediately turn away. He had not made that kind of covenant with his eyes. Instead, he's taking notes. It's registering, and already his affections are being disordered. His mind is being disordered, and his behavior will follow. And in between his mind and his affections, his words are disordered because he has to command someone to go fetch her. He's looking for it. It's not modest speech. It's not modest conduct. Began on his part with a glance. What she did was enticing. But had David, in fact, made a covenant with his eyes, he would have looked away and wouldn't have continued going down that road. It was also a glance that, though it didn't destroy his honesty amongst men, it was, in fact, a glance which brought Joseph to prison for a time. Look at Genesis 39, verse 7.
Genesis 39, verse 7. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me."
The master's wife sees Joseph. How does she react? She reacts in much the same way David does. She's in a position of power. She moves from that glance to making an invitation, which in Joseph's case is declined. Joseph is an honest man. He declines it. Lands him in prison, causes him a lot of heartache. So even in cases, and this is not, in fact, uncommon amongst pagans, when you decline, that you move from a lust relation to a relation of hatred and despising. People don't generally stop in the middle when once they've been that aroused. And this is why it's so important that we control our eyes, that we learn that it's simply not healthy spiritually to be looking at people in such a way that we're being provoked to a breach of this commandment. It's very easy because the eyes, in fact, almost always have that nearly immediate impacting on your mind, on your affections. If you haven't already studied that kind of control, if you haven't already made that kind of covenant with your eyes, things move from what you see, what you're meditating upon, to a disordering of your emotions. And it finds itself into your speech and into your behavior. All of these things are related. They're all functions of your soul upon your body. Your body is the final frontier, where everything has to stop. When you cross that line, you've entered another level of violation of this commandment. And what all of these instructions are designed to do is to keep you from getting to that point where you're going to break out of bounds, where you're going to leave the realm of honesty and integrity in your life and enter that realm where you've become dishonest, where you've become really very oftentimes enslaved to a fantasy. When we look around in modern society, There's a continual assault. A continual invitation to breach this commandment. And as this culture becomes more and more decadent, there are more and more things being thrown up that are designed to make you think that breaches of this commandment are what are normal and natural. Advertising, has made this a cardinal doctrine. They know that provoking people, impassioning people, can get them to buy things that they don't want to or don't need to. But they enter the fray by setting people off kilter. They're trying to impassion you so that you're not thinking rationally, and then they sell you a product. They're selling you a product at the cost of trampling over the seventh commandment. If you are not actively resisting that, it's going to be very easy to be drawn in to that fantasy that they want to create. The eyes are the biggest door to the breach of this commandment. And that's why watchfulness over the eyes has to be considered first here. Nothing else is going to matter if you're not taking control of your eyes. There are, in fact, other senses that need to be watched. There's a sense in which all of them ought to be watched. Physical contact, that has its own tendency. Paul says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. There's a reason for that. This casual mixing of men and women in society is one of the things that leads to breaches of this commandment. But when we consider the other senses, it's especially the ears, whereby men have been made to yield themselves captives to sin, and particularly this sin. Look at Proverbs 5:3.
Proverbs 5:3. For the lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil.
The ears, next to the eyes, the ears are in fact the next sense that is going to entangle you and draw you into a breach of this commandment. This is why chastity with regard to words is so important. Those words are going to be heard by other people. And in certain connections, those words will become provocative. Provocative and, in fact, as Solomon says, having had a lot of experience in this, they're words which are smooth as honey. They're sugary sweet. And they'll draw you in. It's been, in fact, by this sense of hearing, some men have been brought to total destruction. Look at Judges 16, verses 15 to 17.
Judges 16, verses 15 through 17. And she said unto him, How canst thou say, I love thee, when thine heart is not with me? Thou hast mocked me these three times, and hast not told me wherein thy great strength lieth.
And it came to pass when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him so that his soul was vexed unto death, that he told her all his heart and said unto her, There hath not a razor come upon mine head, for I have been a Nazarite unto God from my mother's womb. If I be shaven, then my strength will be gone from me, and I will become weak and like any other man.
Doesn't matter what your resolve is. You may have made a covenant with your eyes, but if you're being pressed hard enough, if the enticement is such that, as Judges says, you're being forced, pressed by those words, words can, in fact, take you captive. You can be drawn in. You can be made to yield. Even if you don't yield by eye, you may end up yielding by ear. Promises that are made, things that are said, enticements that are laid out, draw with an inexorable force. You need to take control of your senses, your eyes and your ears especially. You're probably not going to get to the point where other senses are involved. But the fact is, in our society, the reason for perfumes are to attract. They deliberately put hormones in those perfumes, very often, designed to attract the opposite sex. They're provocative. We're being assaulted by every sense. The church needs to resist, and the church needs to say no. The Christian people ought not to be engaging in these provocative activities, and they should be shunning situations where they're being enticed by them. Right. Additionally, we're told that men need to take care that they study, first of all, temperance, which is, in fact, a sober use of meat, drink, sleep, and recreation. Look at Luke 21:34.
Luke 21:34. And take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that day come upon you unawares.
Temperance is, in fact, a virtue because it is a study of moderation in all things. When you're continually feeding your flesh, when you're continually pampering your body, you're more apt to a breach of this commandment in general. You're open to it. Fornication and adultery become more common in societies which become more effeminate in this sense. They become soft. They become comfortable. Everything is about pampering of the flesh. The greatest pampering of the flesh is going to be found in the breach of this commandment. Temperance is developing an attitude, a balance that seeks to give the body what it needs to survive and not a whole lot more. This is one of the reasons why fasting has such a place in the history of the church. Fasting is one means of gaining control or better control, introducing this idea of temperance to the body. It's a beating down of the body, hemming in of those fleshly desires. Surfeiting, the word that's used here, is krepale. It really means that it's talking about that unrestrained behavior which comes with drunkenness, when people get lightheaded and giddy. When they sort of feel like they're moving outside of themselves and almost floating above themselves. They begin to feel what we would describe nowadays as bulletproof. Look at 1 Samuel 25:36, and we want to look at Habakkuk 2:15 again.
1 Samuel 25, verse 36. And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he held a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunken. Wherefore, she told him nothing, less or more, until the morning light.
Habakkuk 2, verse 15. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness.
That kind of drunkenness, where you're giddy, you can't really receive any serious news. You can't contemplate any weighty matter in life. It has to be put off. Now, when you reach that stage in a situation which is conducive to breach of the seventh commandment, you're probably not going to consider it a very weighty thing. And that's precisely why, then, in Habakkuk we see this idea tied to drunkenness, that is, intemperance, that leads people to gazing upon one another in an unchaste way. Unrestrained behavior is tied to every kind of intemperance, but especially to those kinds of intemperance which, in a sense, tend to divorce your soul from your body. Because if you really are not quite in control of your body anymore, you are, as it were, almost outside of yourself with that giddy lightheadedness, it just doesn't seem like the serious weighty thing that it really is when you breach this command. It's not a matter of great moment. It doesn't affect you. Temperance is a hedge to chastity, which is probably why that was Paul's topic before Drusilla. And the passage we're going to look at here is in Acts 24:24-25.
Acts 24, verse 24 and 25. Then after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning faith in Christ. And as he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, "Go thy way for this time, when I have a convenient season, I will call thee."
It's very likely this proof text ended up here because it is a tradition in the church that Drusilla was married, but left her husband, and left her husband particularly for this Felix, who's in this passage, because he found her irresistible. She was a Jewess. Her intemperance is registered in the annals of history. When Paul stands before her, he points to, among other things, this idea of temperance. And it is thought that one of the reasons that he's pointing to this here, and this is probably why, again, this passage appears as a proof text, is that it was her intemperance that led her to leave her lawful husband, enter into this adulterous relationship, and misbehave in total defiance of the command of God. So temperance is an important part of that recipe for keeping this command pure and entire. If you want to study purity, chastity, if you want to live honestly, you need to learn to be temperate. There's a reason why the Bible in general talks about temperance with regard to food and drink. We talked about that a little bit with respect to the sixth commandment. It has an effect on the body. And here we can see that that effect on the body, that negative effect on the body, is also tied directly, very often, to the breach of not merely the sixth, but the seventh commandments. Another thing that men should take care is that they keep chaste and modest company. Look at Proverbs 2, 16 to 20.
Proverbs 2, to deliver thee from the strange woman, even from the stranger which flattereth with her words, which forsaketh the guide of her youth and forgetteth the covenant of her God. For her house is unto death, and her paths unto the dead. None that go unto her return again, neither take they hold of the paths of life. But thou mayest walk in the way of good men and keep the paths of the righteous.
Proverbs is a very interesting book. It holds forth, it's holding forth, and this really goes back, the Jews have a very long idea of catechizing, and it shows up in an early Christian document called the Didache, the teaching, of the, presenting side by side the way of life and the way of death. And Proverbs is doing that. It juxtaposes this idea of this is the way of life versus this is a way of death. And at the very beginning of Proverbs, we see already that the way of death begins for a lot of people by their failure to keep chaste and modest company. In fact, Solomon indicates that it's very hard to extricate yourself from that once you've gone into it. In fact, he indicates it's nearly impossible, which is why he warns you about this. We have a lot of problems in modern society with not just fornication, but with pornography and things like that. These things are problems because they are addictive. That would be the modern word. The old word would be bewitching. They exert an influence over you that is very, very difficult for you ever to gain control over again. Many people have been ruined by the ill company they keep. Ill company wears off insensibly the impressions of virtue on people's spirits. Look at 1 Corinthians 15:33.
1 Corinthians 15, verse 33. Be not deceived. Evil communications corrupt good manners.
Evil communications corrupt good manners. Why is it that the church has always been very circumspect in keeping people out of these kinds of situations? Because they're enticing. You know, men and women who are interested in each other should not be alone together prior to being married. It's dangerous for men and women to be alone together individually anyway. But if there's interest, it's only heightened. You know, you're casting fuel on a fire, a raging fire. And you're being warned it's going to ruin you. Chaste and modest company is that kind of company that's going to be continually pouring water on that fire. You're not going to be sitting there trying to provoke you, to draw you out, to get you meditating on things that you shouldn't be meditating on. in trying to entice you to sin. They're not going to be behaving, acting, dressing in ways designed to lead you on in this way, to disorder your passions more. Chaste and modest company will be encouraging you to be chaste and modest yourself. Maintaining peace and converse with the wicked, in fact, makes people like them, which is the reason for Solomon's warning. Look at Proverbs 5, verses 8 and 9.
Proverbs 5, verses 8 and 9. Remove thy way far from her, and come not nigh the door of her house, lest thou give thine honor unto others, and thy years unto the cruel.
Proverbs says, if you take fire in your bosom, you're going to get burned. People who think that they can rub shoulders with loose and lascivious people, that it's not going to rub off on them, that it's not going to affect them, are deluded. People who think that they can control themselves, people who think that they have that kind of self-control, don't know the power of indwelling sin. It doesn't matter how sanctified you are. Paul says evil communications corrupt good manners. He doesn't say they may. He says they do. You're going to be affected by it. Your conscience will be seared. Your sense of virtue will be lowered. Your entire worldview will be eroded. Keeping company with people who are habitually in violation of this commandment is a prescription for soul ruin. Chaste and modest company will help you in an area where you need help. And you need it especially in your youth. These are sins that ruin the young and destroy your pleasure in later years. The third thing that we should study, men need to take care to study, is modesty in apparel. It's another hedge against uncleanness, and it's a sign of chastity. Look at 1 Timothy 2:9.
1 Timothy 2:9. In like manner also, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly array.
Paul warns women in particular against excess in apparel. The use of jewelry, elaborate hairdos. The word that he uses for modest there, well, is something we're going to have to deal with separately at some point, but it has to do with community sensibilities. Now, we're going to have to talk about, at some point, what community we're talking about, whether the community of the world or the community of the church. But I think you probably already know what the answer should be. The fact is that modesty in apparel, Paul says, is not simply going to put a hedge, that is, it's not going to provoke other people, but Paul actually makes it a sign, an indication of chastity, inward chastity. And you should understand that that is the case if you understand what is involved in what we went over before. Control of your mind, control of your affections, control of your words and behavior are going to lead to a desire and a willingness to put a hedge about yourself for your own benefit and for the benefit of others. Right, studying modesty inclines the heart to those inward exercises of religion which alone are profitable. Look at 1 Peter 3:3-5.
1 Peter 3:3-5. Whose adorning let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair, and of wearing of gold, or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. For after this manner, in the old time, the holy women also, who trusted in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands.
And again, without wanting to spend a lot of time tonight on this point, although I do think it's a very important point, something we're going to spend quite a bit of time on at some future date, Lord willing, it is important to note that one of the things that Peter is pointing out is that inward adornment and outward adornment are opposite. They're opposites. In other words, the more outward adornment, the less inward adornment is likely going on, and vice versa. They don't peacefully coexist in the same person. Modesty, chastity don't peacefully coexist in people who are, in fact, concerned about this external adorning. Adornment is about calling attention to yourself. And calling attention to yourself is about gaining the attention of, usually, the opposite sex. So that's the purpose of the adorning. And that is contrary to this chastity of spirit that both Peter and Paul are talking about. So we do need to understand what you wear is not a matter of quote-unquote Christian liberty. There are a lot of people who think that you can do whatever you want in this realm and it's okay. There are a number of general rules that are set down in the Word of God. There are matters which are light of nature issues. And Christian prudence brought to bear on that has, in fact, quite a bit to say on what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. If you have a desire for chastity, that kind of purity, that honesty of commerce between people, then you're going to be concerned about this matter of attiring. If you're not concerned with this, you need to ask yourself whether or not you in fact have a proper disposition toward God. All right, fourth. They note that for those who have not the gift of continency, this duty requires the seeking of marriage. Look at 1 Corinthians 7, verses 2 and 9.
1 Corinthians 7, verse 2. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. And verse 9. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn.
Some people have the gift of continency. Jesus says there are some men who are born eunuchs, and others who become eunuchs for the kingdom of God's sake. That is, they've suppressed that passion. If you don't have the gift of continency, either naturally or by grace, Paul says, then you need to marry. Marriage is a remedy. It's not a shield for everything, as we talked about last week. It's not a shield for any kind of thing. It's not an anything goes proposition. But it is, in fact, when properly used, a remedy for the excess and for the disorder. Within the bonds of matrimonial affection, there's that shield of conjugal love. Look at Proverbs 5:19-20.
Proverbs 5, verses 19 and 20. Let her be as the loving hind in pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger?
Yep. Again, Solomon has a lot of advice on this issue. And he's saying that in the matrimonial bond, there is conjugal love, which is a shield that is going to protect you. We have a situation in modern society that for a number of centuries has not been a huge problem in the West, but now has been. And this is one of the things he's referring to there. Illegitimacy. When you are, in fact, in a conjugal relation with one person, that woman is nursing your child. That woman is, in fact, embracing your children. Your children are not being scattered all over the world. We live now in a society that's so perverted that people routinely refer to the women with whom they're having children as baby mamas. Solomon says, why would you be doing this? Allowing your children to be raised by strange women. Women you don't even know. You want your children being raised by a woman you know and can trust with your children. We daily hear horror stories that occur because of this situation. So marriage is a shield. It's a shield not only that protects the man and the woman who are involved, it also protects the children from all of the disorders. It's coupled with the comfort of cohabitation. Look at 1 Peter 3:7.
1 Peter 3:7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, may your prayers be not hindered.
There is temptation that comes when people do not cohabitate. And this is one reason, again, why Paul says that husbands and wives are not to be absent from one another for lengthy periods of time, lest Satan take occasion and there's great temptation. The converse of that is there is a level of comfort. There is, in fact, a rule that will keep you in line so that you're not so tempted to step over this commandment in breach of it. The fifth thing that they point out that we should be careful to study is being busied about some honest employment. That cuts off many temptations open to those who are idle. Look at Proverbs 31:11, 27, and 28.
Proverbs 31:11, the heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. Verse 27 and 28, she looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her.
When people are busy about something, some kind of honest employment, it gives them less time to think about things, to inflame passions, to engage in conversations and behaviors which lead to breaches of this commandment. That idea of being able to trust that Solomon talks about here in Proverbs 31. Trust is what you can do when you have a situation where you know people are honest. This idea that people have that you should trust them simply on their say-so when their behavior pattern gives you no reason to believe that they're trustworthy is foolishness. And this, again, is one reason why there's such a crisis in modern culture, why marriages disintegrate so easily, why people are in and out of all of these horrible, foul relationships, siring bastard children all over the place. Honesty is tied inherently to chastity. That whole debate that went on with Clinton, if his wife can't trust him, how can we? And other people said, and a lot of people in this country believe that what you do in your private life doesn't matter and has no effect on anyone else. Yes, it does, because it defines you as someone who is either fundamentally honest or fundamentally dishonest. And fundamentally dishonest people cannot be trusted in anything. So trust is tied with this. Honest employment is tied with this. Honesty in all departments of life put off and displace the dishonesty that wants to come in breach of this commandment. That's why honest employments take away these temptations. Had David taken to the field with his army, he might have avoided temptation. Go again, let's look at 2 Samuel 11:2 again.
2 Samuel 11, verse 2. And it came to pass in an evening tide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon.
Yeah, when was it all this happened with David? We know he didn't have control of his eyes. We know that Bathsheba was doing something provocative and ensnaring. But David could have avoided this altogether had he been engaged in some honest employment. He should have been out. It was a time when kings went to war. And where was he? He was at home. When all the other kings are out doing king business, David was at home, doing nothing. Had he been involved in an honest employment, this entrance, this opportunity for dishonesty would never have occurred. Had Dinah been about the business of her father's house, she might have preserved her own chastity. Look at Genesis 34, 1 and 2.
Genesis 34, verses 1 and 2. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her.
How did this happen? Dinah is a daughter in Israel. She went out to see the daughters of the land. And Paul warns women about going about from house to house. Why? He's concerned about this issue of fundamental honesty. And you're placing yourself in a very dangerous position. Dinah put herself at risk. She should have been doing what her father wanted her to do, taking care of things that were needed to be taken care of for him. Instead, she's out wandering about, gadding about from house to house, in all likelihood gossiping. In the course of it, she meets with a ne'er-do-well. And she's defiled. If she had been about honest employment, she wouldn't have been, and she wouldn't have found herself amongst the company of people who were not engaged in honest employment. They were idle. They were busybodies. They were going here and there. And that led to her defilement. The last thing that they warn, and active, we should be very active in shunning all occasions of uncleanness and resisting temptations thereunto. Look again at Proverbs 5:8.
Proverbs 5:8, remove thy way far from her, and come not nigh to the door of her house.
Yeah, Solomon does not say, as long as you know the amount of self-control you have, it's okay to walk that way. He says, remove yourself far from her. Be active. You know, when you think you can handle it, what you're really doing is you're toying with breach of this commandment. Most people don't begin crossing this line in one egregious act of lewdness and immorality. Most people begin a little at a time. Keep walking by that door where you know sin dwells, and you know that there is this enticing voice and this enticing vision. It's only a matter of time before you cross that doorway in a moment of weakness and are met by a sin that's laying in wait for its proper time and opportunity. You need to shun, avoid all occasion of uncleanness. That's exactly what we see Joseph doing in Genesis 39, verses 8 to 10.
Genesis 39, verses 8 through 10. But he refused and said unto his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And it came to pass, as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her.
And Joseph didn't really have the freedom to get away entirely, but he was very clear from the beginning. And he didn't hearken. That is to say, once he stated his position, he didn't listen to anything she said, no matter how much she said it. She kept saying it again and again and again and again. And he didn't listen. He didn't hear her. He closed his ears. Put his hands over his ears. Wouldn't hear it. He wouldn't let her force him with her words. And when she finally is so enraged with her passion and grabs him and tries to force him, he flees. That's how much resolve Joseph had. We need to avoid as much as we can these kinds of situations. Very few people have anywhere near the amount of resolve that Joseph has. And had this occurred in a different time frame, for all we know, Joseph himself might have given in. You know, we are men composed of flesh and blood, and that flesh and blood is fallen and impassioned, distorted, and in a state of what theologians call moral turpitude. It's like a churning when you look at a muddy puddle. That's what you are inside. You've got all this sin clouding what should be clear water. It's in contact with every part of you. And if you allow yourself to continually rub shoulders with opportunities to breach this commandment, in all likelihood, it's not a question of if, but a question of when you will fall into that puddle. Next time, we want to talk about the sins which are forbidden and deal with the enumeration of things there, because there are, in fact, more warnings and special directions in the negative side that we might learn to avoid and any breach of this commandment.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit puritandownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.